Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, economist Diane Lim, and Senior Fellow from Brookings, Bill Gale, in a special Economist Mom segment. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Some House Democrats are hoping that an amendment to raise non-defense funding will muster enough support on the House floor to be added to a bill that would raise discretionary spending limits for the coming two fiscal years. Other Democrats worry it could tank the overall bill. But still, some Democrats have complained that the spending caps bill would provide too much defense spending at the expense of non-defense programs, which prompted this particular amendment. Even if the two-year spending cap legislation doesn't make it to the House floor, an overall top line of $1.295 billion for fiscal year 2020 could still be set by appropriators due to a rule that would force debate on the bill this week. The proposed spending caps bill would increase the limits for both defense and non-defense spending imposed by a 2011 deficit reduction law by $356 billion over the next two fiscal years. But overall, defense-related accounts would still get nearly $150 billion more than non-defense programs, mostly because of a $138 billion boost to a war-related account known as Overseas Contingency Operations, which is exempt from spending limits. The bill is not likely to gain much traction in the Republican-controlled Senate, but it could be an opening bid for new spending caps as negotiations move forward. A legislative effort to reduce health care costs will start with small changes. Republican senators announced plans to address health care costs in a piecemeal fashion. Possible measures include one aimed at preventing patients from receiving surprise medical bills, expanding the use of health savings accounts, and making health care prices and data more transparent. Former Senator Ernest F. Hollings, a Democrat from South Carolina, passed away over the weekend at the age of 97. Hollings was a World War II veteran, South Carolina governor, and he served in the Senate from 1966 until 2004. Hollings was a founding member of the Senate Budget Committee in 1975. He served on the Senate Appropriations Committee from 1971 until his retirement, and he co-authored the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Law in 1985, which outlined a path to balanced budgets by 1991 and was enforced by across-the-board cuts known as sequester. The federal budget deficit reached $693 billion in the first half of this fiscal year, up $94 billion over the same period last year, says the Congressional Budget Office. Revenue was up 1%, or $9 billion, but spending was up 5%, or $103 billion. According to CBO, the increases in spending were driven by defense, interest payments on the debt, and mandatory spending in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Up next, Bill Gale and economist Diane Lim will join me and Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby for the next edition of The Economist Mom. We'll be talking about Gale's new book, Fiscal Therapy, Curing America's Debt Addiction and Investing in the Future. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by economist Diane Lim, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and Bill Gale. Diane and Bob, you know well, both are regular contributors on the show. Bill is the R.J. and Francis Miller Chair in Federal Economic Policy and a senior fellow in the Economic Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. His research focuses on tax policy, fiscal policy, pensions, and saving behavior. He's co-director of the Tax Policy Center, a joint venture of the Brookings Institute and the Urban Institute. He's also director of the Retirement Security Project. In addition to having an impressive resume of experience, Bill attended Duke University and the London School of Economics and received his PhD from Stanford University. He's also the author of Fiscal Therapy, Curing America's Debt Addiction and Investing in the Future, which was just published and the topic of the show today. Welcome to the show, Bob, Diane, and Bill.
Thank you, Chase.
Thank you, Chase.
Thank you.
Well, happy to have you all on the show, especially you, Bill, to talk about your new book that was just published. And the three of us are going to pepper you with questions. So let's start with a bit of a softball. Just generally, what are the overarching themes of your book, and why did you think it was important to write it now?
Thanks, Chase. The book focuses on two major issues facing American society. First, we have rising federal debt. Second, we are lagging investments in crucial areas like early childhood and infrastructure. The book analyzes these issues and then proposes a three-part solution to the problem. I wanted to write this book because these issues are creepingly growing, and they're coming to dominate, I think, the economic and fiscal and social policy discussion. And I thought that an integrated treatment of them was important because there are so many interactive moving parts.
So, Bill, you mentioned some of the problems that you analyze in your book. Can you give us a quick rundown of what some of those major issues are, the challenges you think our country is facing right now that need to be addressed?
When I first started writing the book, I thought it was going to be a book solely about debt reduction and the long-term fiscal shortfall that the country faces. As I got into the research, I realized that the issue was not just the debt level, which is a issue of the level of spending versus the level of taxes. The issue was also the way we spend money and the way we raise revenues. And so we need to reform the structure of spending to move toward a more investment-oriented society, just as we need to reform the structure of taxes to make the tax system more efficient and less harmful to the economy. So the book really is the result of the interaction of both of those issues.
You know, Bill, this is a very timely book. One thing that I picked up on is that you wrote, this time is different. I mean, we've had periods in our nation's history before where we're worried about the deficit and the debt. And if you could explain that a little bit, why the timing and the magnitude right now makes this different than past episodes of worry about the debt.
Sure. Up until 1980, from basically the time of the Constitution to 1980, we only had big debt run-ups during wars and economic downturns. Wars would cause spending to skyrocket. Economic downturns would cause revenue to plummet. And then as soon as the war or the recession ended, things would return to normal and we would pay down the debt. So the debt run-ups were temporary. They were caused by specifically identifiable factors, and they were reversed as soon as those factors ended. What we have now is quite different. What we have now is a steady, chronic, built-in imbalance between revenues and outlays, and this imbalance is expected to rise over time. There's no war that's going to end that's going to right military spending. There's no recession that's going to end that's going to boost revenues. Indeed, one of the concerning aspects of this is the deficit has gone up even though the economy has done so well the last couple of years. So the deficit problem, the deficit situation that we face now is quite different from anyone that we've faced in the past.
And I think one of the things that readers would get from your book is just the magnitude of the problem. I mean, it's easy to get lost in thinking about year-to-year deficits, which are big enough. But you illustrate in your book a series of policy options, some of which we'll get to later, that would, quote-unquote, solve the problem. So you set a target for debt-to-GDP ratio, so we have a sustainable budget. And I wonder if you could describe that target and just how big the policy changes are just to get to that target that you set.
Sure. In round numbers, debt to GDP is about 80% right now. That is, the debt level is about 80% of 1 year's annual output. Under current policies, it's supposed to rise to about 180% of GDP by 2050, 30 years from now. In contrast, the highest we ever had in the past was 106% just after the Second World War. So the question is, what do we do with this path that's taking us to 180% of GDP? I propose that we have a target that the debt be 60% of GDP by 2050, so that it comes down by 120% of GDP from what the baseline forecast is. That requires, and we can talk about why that target makes sense, or what people's objections to that target might be. But let's take that target for a second. That would require us to raise taxes and or cut spending by an average of 4% of GDP on an immediate permanent basis. So that would be the equivalent of about a 50% increase in income taxes, or a 25% increase in all taxes, or a 20% reduction in all spending other than net interest. And so these are.
And that would be every year.
That would be immediate and permanent, yes. And so these are enormous changes. Just to get us back to what you might call a normal steady state.
And just to be clear, the 60% of GDP, which is your target, is still considerably higher than we've normally had. Say in the post World War II era, I think the 50-year average is somewhere a little north of 40% of GDP for our debt to GDP ratio. So we're roughly double that now, and your goal would bring it back down, but not all the way back down to where it traditionally has been, but considerably lower than where it's headed, because it's headed so far north. But those changes really, I think, will strike the reader as quite significant. I mean, they should. It shows the magnitude of the problem. If you're going to have a program that ambitious, presumably you'd need to phase it in somewhat over time. Is that right, for policy changes?
That's right. The later the proposal starts, the bigger the adjustments have to be. I set it up in the book so that the adjustments all start in 2021.
And that's for illustrative purposes.
That's for illustrative purposes, exactly. It shows how big the impact, how big the changes have to be. It seems unlikely that Congress would be able to do everything all in one grand bargain. If you look back in the 1980s, we had a whole series of major reforms from 1981 to 1997. And the idea of collapsing all of those issues into one, as well as doing Medicare and Medicaid reform on top of it, just seems impossible. But the idea behind fiscal therapy is sort of like the idea behind physical therapy, which is you work on these things one at a time, you get them better, you move to the next issue, you work on that one. So I think Congress and the president and really the American people have a long series of issues here that they will have to grapple with.
And Bill, I just wanted to jump in here real quick before we got too far down the road beyond talking about some of these debt to GDP targets. You mentioned that starting in 2021 towards that target was for illustrative purposes. Is a 60% debt to GDP ratio in 2050 also for illustrative purposes, or is there an economic meaning or significance behind that specific target beyond just the fact that we want to bring it down from our near 80% now closer to the historic average?
So you're asking, what is the right debt level? What is the right sustainable debt level in the long term? And the answer is, it depends. It depends on a lot of factors. One of the factors it depends on is what our current debt level is and what our projected debt level is. And so because the projected level is rising so high, that constrains what we can or should do in terms of bringing it down. So that's one reason why the 60% target is higher than the historical average. Another reason is that interest rates are projected to be lower than they have been in the past, and that helps ease the burden of the debt somewhat. So you can carry more debt if interest rates are somewhat lower. But there's another argument that people use for not worrying about the debt, that is letting the debt rise, which I think is wrong. And that is that future generations are going to be better off than we are. They're going to have higher income than we are, so they can afford more debt relative to the economy than we can. And the concern with that is exemplified in research by Raj Shetty at Harvard and other people who show that the percent of people who do better than their parents in an absolute sense has fallen dramatically. It was, for people born in 1940, about 90% of them did better than their parents in terms of absolute income levels. For people born in 1980, just over half have done better than their parents in the terms of the absolute income level. What's happening is the widening distribution of income has been making it harder to guarantee that each generation, that the members of the family of each generation will be better off than the members of the generation before them. So in my view, that limits somewhat the extent to which we can simply pass debt on to future generations. Finally, there's one other issue that affects what the sustainable level of debt is, and that is how the government uses the funds. And so if the government follows the recommendations in the book and shifts toward more investment in children, in infrastructure, research and development, and so on, then we can sustain more debt because we're growing the economy. And so that's a reason why the 60% debt level might be higher than the historical average.
And Bill, before we get into some of your recommendations, what happens if we just let it roll? I mean, what's the end game here of the consequences of inaction as the debt rolls up to 100-200% of GDP?
My late colleague Charlie Schultz had this great line that deficits were the termites in the woodwork, not the wolf at the door. And what he meant by that was discussion of a crisis, of fomenting a crisis, is probably overblown. The U.S. is the safest place to invest in the world, and that's not likely to change anytime soon. The other problem with emphasizing the crisis aspect of things is it implicitly suggests that the problem is that there might be a crisis, whereas in my view, the problem is precisely the opposite, that it's just gradual eating away at the capital stock or increasing our foreign indebtedness. Either way, mortgaging our future in a slow, steady, gradual way that reduces the growth of living standards, makes it harder for American families to do the things that they want to do. This is a tricky thing to convey because the impact, in a way, is invisible. And let me explain that. If there's an earthquake and it knocks down a building and you see a pile of rubble, then it's very natural to walk past that pile of rubble and say, oh, that earthquake knocked down that building. But if you walk by an empty lot, it's not really natural to think, oh, the government borrowed so much money that businesses couldn't take loans and invest and build a building there. But that's the nature of the problem. It's gradual, and that doesn't mean it's not big. It doesn't mean it's not as exciting as a crisis, but it's, I think it's just as important.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, economist Diane Lim, and Senior Fellow at Brookings, Bill Gale. We're discussing Bill's new book and the importance of addressing our nation's fiscal challenges. Sorry for cutting you off there, Bob. I'll roll right back to you.
Well, thanks, Chase. I want to bring in Diane into this conversation because she's been sitting here and we've taken over her segment. This is an Economist Mom segment. And everybody but Economist Mom has been doing all the talking. But bringing Diane into her own show here, I just wanted to mention that she and Bill do know each other. And in fact, Diane liked the book so much, and that and Bill appreciated her help so much that in fact they're getting married in July. So with that, the disclosure, Diane, I thought, do you have any questions?
Who could say no to someone who wrote so eloquently about the number one issue that Economist Mom has always cared about and written about and spoken about?
Should we call Bill Economist Dad?
He is an Economist Dad.
That's right.
He's just not the Economist Dad to the same children that Economist Mom is mom to. That's
all right.
So, you know, one thing I wanted to jump in on, because you guys were so getting kind of deep in the debt to GDP issue, and Bill, you mentioned what happens when interest rates come down and the lack of kind of crisis, but rather slow kind of deterioration. And it's been one thing that's really frustrated, I know, myself and you in recent years, is how many people say interest rates are so low. What is the problem? Why are you guys still talking about, you know, the importance of fiscal sustainability when it's so cheap to borrow? Doesn't that mean we should be borrowing more, not less? And so I'm wondering if you can talk about what is your response, especially these days with modern monetary theory and all this talk about there's no cost to borrowing. How have you been kind of pushing back on that a little bit to defend this concern, our own ongoing concern about the fiscal outlook?
I think there are several aspects to this. Certainly interest rates have come down, and certainly that helps the budget in the short run because it reduces interest payments. But there's a catch here that if you borrow money, you want interest rates to be low. If you're a saver, you want interest rates to be high. And so the federal government is kind of in both situations. It's obviously borrowed a lot of money, but it also needs to be saving, in a sense, to pay for future Social Security and Medicare expenses. And the low interest rates will make it harder to pre-fund those obligations. So on net, lower interest rates probably help the federal budget, but the longer you go out in the forecast, the less low interest rates do help because of these obligations in the future. Having said that, I should also say that the forecast we were talking about earlier of the debt going to 180% of GDP, all of those include the assumption that the interest rate stays below the growth rate of the economy. So they're already low interest rate forecasts. They are already deficit forecasts based on relatively low interest rates. The concern is that people decide that interest rates are going to stay low. They borrow up a storm. We raise the debt enormously, and then interest rates rise. And then all of a sudden, we're stuck with higher interest rates as well as a higher debt, which would then send net interest payments through the roof. So I think the low interest rates are an important phenomenon. I think they maybe reduce the urgency of addressing the longer-run situation, but the longer-term fiscal shortfall is still there. And we still need to address it. So, for example, I don't think we need to cut this year's budget deficit to address the long-term fiscal shortfall, but putting in place a plan to reduce future years' deficits and to sort of bend the curve on the debt-to-GDP ratio is still a good idea.
So, Bill, all of this talk of the issues in the analysis you engaged in your book brings the question to the front of my mind, and that is, what are the solutions? What do we actually need to do? What do you propose that we do about a lot of these challenges?
I've laid out what you might call a three-part solution in the book. The first one is to reform Social Security and Medicare in ways that restore their long-term solvency, but also protect their anti-poverty role and their social insurance role. It's really important if you want to attack spending to focus on those two programs, because Social Security, healthcare, defense, and net interest collectively count for about 70% of the federal budget. Defense is already fairly low. Net interest, we can't do a lot about. That leaves Social Security and Medicare. So the first tenet is to reform those two major programs. The second part is to what you might call go long on America, and that is invest in children, invest in infrastructure, invest in research and development. I propose that we carve out 1% of GDP for new investments in social policy, whether that's children or educational attainment or making work pay for low-income households and so on. There's a major infrastructure and R&D investment program listed as well. The third part, then, after Social Security and Medicare and after investing in America, the third part is to raise and reform taxes. This is a full-throated argument that we need to raise taxes. We cannot get where we need to go with the current tax system. This raises the inevitable objection that raising taxes will hurt the economy and so on, and that does not have to be the case. The evidence suggests that higher taxes do not have to reduce the economic growth rate. For example, European countries, the other G7 countries besides the United States, have about 25% higher taxes than we do, but their per capita growth rate has been about the same for the last 40 to 50 years. And the reason is that they raise those taxes through a value-added tax, which is basically a consumption tax, like a retail sales tax, but collected at each stage of production rather than all at the retail level. And as a consumption tax, the value-added tax does not distort saving or investment choices. So it's a very growth-friendly tax. In addition, we need a carbon tax for fiscal reasons, but also for all the environmental reasons that we need to fight climate change. And the third set of taxes that we need is higher taxes on the wealthy. And there are several reasons for this. First, income and wealth at the top has skyrocketed over the last 40 years, but their average tax rate has remained about the same. That is, taxes as a share of their income have remained about the same. In a system like ours, when your income goes up, your taxes as a share of your income are supposed to go up too. But the highest income households have benefited from tax cuts in 1981 and 2001, 2017. And we need to correct that trend, I think. The other way to look at it is higher taxes are really the only way to get wealthy households to share in the fiscal burden. There's no spending initiative that you can cut that would significantly affect households at the very top of the income or wealth distribution. So just to recap, reform Social Security and Medicare is point one. Invest in America and children and infrastructure and research is point two. Raise and reform taxes is the third point, with the main items there being a consumption tax, a carbon tax, and raising taxes on wealthy and high-income households.
On the health care front, that's such a big conundrum of slowing the growth of health care costs. What are some of the recommendations generally that you have for that?
Health care is an enormously complex issue. If the health care sector in the U.S. were a separate country, it would be the fourth largest country in the world. So it's very difficult. It's very difficult to simplify too much. But I think filling out, raising coverage, ensuring that all people are covered is an important initiative. And there's a way to do that by expanding Medicaid, by putting a public option on the state-run exchanges, and so on. But the other key imperative is to control costs. And there, one of the key statistics to think about is that the 5% of people in any given year with the highest health care costs account for half of all healthcare expenditures in the country, whereas the 50% of people with the lowest healthcare costs account for 3%. What that means is that policies like expanded health savings accounts, which give incentives for healthy people to economize on their health spending, won't do anything or won't do very much to deal with aggregate healthcare spending. If that bottom 50% that accounts for just 3% of spending, even if they cut their spending a lot, it's just not going to show up as much in terms of aggregate spending. And where the money is in reducing the incidence and the cost of the high-cost episodes. And so that involves reforming Medicare, and then here the focus is on Medicare because Medicare is something like 20% of all healthcare spending in the country, and it kind of serves as a market leader. So if Medicare can institute reforms, experience suggests that the rest of the medical field follows those reforms. So if we can introduce more competition in the provision of Medicare policies through premium support policies, that would help. If we could reform the way we pay doctors and other providers of medicine by paying for quality of care and output rather than paying for inputs, that would help. And I think it's critical that we let Medicare negotiate the prices of the pharmaceuticals that it buys to provide patients. Now, to do that, you have to let it negotiate the formulary as well. You have to let it negotiate which drugs are actually on the list. But VA and Medicaid pay far less than Medicare for the identical items, and that seems like an enormous waste of money. So
well,
I think there are...
It seems illogical. You have various government agencies playing by different rules on that.
Right. And it seems like healthcare is one area where there could be substantial spending cuts without substantial benefit cuts for individuals simply by making the sector more efficient.
Looking at Social Security, what are some of the solutions there for making the system solvent?
The Social Security package I proposed is based on the proposal that a commission that the Bipartisan Policy Center put together a couple years ago. I should say I was a member of that commission, and it's a fairly middle-of-the-road solution. It raises the retirement age. It adjusts benefits for inflation. It's got an increase in the payroll tax cap, and almost all serious Social Security reform proposals have those three elements. It's got a couple of other features. It tries to bolster benefits at the bottom, because if you raise retirement age, you can be hurting low-income workers who have had physical jobs who need to retire. But it's basically a balancing act between those items, with the main items being the later retirement age and raising the payroll tax cap.
And that later retirement age is also part of it's not just a cost-saving thing, but it's more of a keeping people in the workforce longer, because we have a changing demographic that we need workers. And those are often valuable workers that you want to retain in the workforce.
And that's one of the big differences between now and back in the 1980s, when we had the last set of bipartisan budget reforms. We had very favorable demographic headwinds at that point. We had the baby boomers entering the labor market. We had them moving into their high earning years, their high home purchase years, and so on. Now we've got the baby boomers retiring to the tune of like 10,000 people a day. And that is putting stress on federal spending, but it's also reducing the boost we get from the economy.
So that leads to one of your other points, which is investing at the federal level. The federal government doesn't do a great job of investing. Just looking at the numbers, it seems like the portion of the federal budget that's devoted to investing in things that could increase the productivity of the workforce is getting squeezed and has been continually squeezed over the last decades. And so part of your solution is for the federal government to look more at what it can do to help boost productivity through investment.
That's right. And infrastructure is one of two keys there. Diane and I were driving on the Beltway just yesterday and commenting on how badly the roads were paved. And my favorite anecdote here is that things have gotten so bad that Domino's Pizza has in certain localities helped fill potholes and things like that, so its drivers can deliver pizzas to people's houses. More formally,
that sounds like a third world thing.
Well, it does have a banana republic aspect to it. And you hear these stories about air traffic controllers using post-it notes to keep track of flights and stuff like that.
I don't want to hear it.
No.
Yeah. More formally, net federal investment in infrastructure, that is the new investment minus the depreciation of the existing capital stock, has been pretty close to zero over the last two decades. And in the 90s, when the budget was tightened, investments like infrastructure got the axe. Because the economic benefits of infrastructure are not explicitly captured in the budget, and because they're delayed, it makes it an obvious target for spending reductions. But we need to reverse that. There's all sorts of opportunities, not just to rebuild existing infrastructure, but to build new modern infrastructure that can help the economy move to the next level.
And investment can be in people, it can be in education. There's a lot of ways that the federal government could boost its R&D, basic scientific research. There are a lot of ways that it can improve.
Bill, we just ran through a whole litany of reform options and the plan you lay out that policymakers could actually pursue. And I'm up here in New Hampshire. It's no secret the New Hampshire primary is fast approaching. We've got candidates running all over the state talking about a lot of different issues, and not many of them relate back to what your book identifies as major challenges for our country and some of the potential solutions to them. So I guess my final question for you is more about the politics of all this. So what are the political realities to these issues, the reforms you suggest? Can Congress even pick up on this? Are we even there right now as a nation, as a federal government?
So sooner or later, every discussion of deficits and fiscal policy turns to politics and, you know, is that really possible? Are they really going to do anything? And the short answer right now is no, they're not going to do anything. The public is not focused on this because they lead busy lives and they don't necessarily have time to think about policy all day. The politicians are not focused on it because they're not ready to propose solutions to the problem, so they don't want to raise the problem. There's a number of aspects of our political system that make the problem more difficult. The first, the founding fathers set up the government so that big changes were difficult to make. Second, many, perhaps most Republicans assigned the No New Taxes pledge, which makes it very difficult to discuss fiscal reform because it takes tax revenues off the table. It's not clear why one side should be able to sort of take half of the budget, half of the problem off the table before even negotiating. I mean, there are a variety of other issues as well. The partisanship, the tribalism, the polarization in recent years has made moving forward on anything more difficult. But it makes fiscal policy particularly difficult because the sides have to trust each other that whatever long-term, multifaceted solution they come up with will actually be implemented, that they won't be the sucker left holding the bag while the other side repeals the stuff that it doesn't like when it comes to power. So I think the political environment is making it very difficult to even think about long-term fiscal issues. But I think there's hope, and the hope falls in several categories. First is fiscal sustainability is both a conservative and a liberal goal, or at least it's consistent with conservative and liberal goals. If you're a conservative, you want a sound government. If you want a liberal, if you're a liberal, you want an active government that requires resources. In either case, you know, your fiscal sustainability is consistent with what you're trying to pursue. The second point is that although the benefits are in the future and sometimes hard to see, there are substantial benefits to fiscal reform. And in the book, I talk about the effect on the economy as a whole, the economy expanding, growing, but also making the distribution of income more equal, increasing economic mobility. So there are benefits there. And the quote that I like is to emphasize is one that's often attributed to Winston Churchill, but it turns out if anyone said it, it was Abba Ibun, the Israeli politician. And that is, you can always count on the Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted all the other options. So that is usually the thought that I try to keep in the back of my mind as I review the frustrations of the moment in the political world.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby, economist Diane Lim, and Senior Fellow at Brookings Bill Gale discuss Bill's new book and the importance of addressing our nation's fiscal challenges. Thank you all for joining the show.
You're welcome, Chase. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Chase.
The name of the book is Fiscal Therapy.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. There are fiscal exposures that could increase our national debt even more than the current rate of growth. Federal budget projections are already quite alarming, with the national debt high by historical standards and rising rapidly. The fiscal picture looks even worse, however, if one takes into account federal insurance programs and other activities that transfer financial risks and losses to the government, and ultimately, of course, to the taxpayers of today and tomorrow. A recent report from the Government Accountability Office, or GAO, on these, quote, fiscal exposures provides a forceful reminder to elected officials and the American public of how these programs and activities could result in billions of dollars in additional federal spending that current projections do not include. The report also looks at the future costs of benefits for federal employees and veterans and discusses the big federal mandatory spending programs. The GAO said that the government's primarily cash-based budget generally does not record the full cost of commitments incurred until corresponding payments are made in the future. Therefore, the budget may not accurately reflect federal costs or the likely claim on federal resources for such activities. For some claims, such as pension and life insurance, the federal commitment occurs years before payments are reflected in the budget. Unlike private insurance, for some federal programs, GAO says, even when premiums or fees exist, they may not cover all costs, as federal expenditures can be driven by policy goals or agency missions rather than the aim of fiscal solvency. GAO notes that federal social insurance programs like Social Security and Medicare all provide benefits that transfer risk to the federal government. In fact, GAO has warned that spending growth in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid have been largely driven by the aging of the population and increasing health care costs rather than legislative changes to those programs. Putting a point on it, GAO said, absent policy changes, the federal government's fiscal path is unsustainable. Elected officials in Washington should heed that warning as well as GAO's concern that a wide range of fiscal risks and liabilities are not being taken into account in the federal budget process. Congress should consider improvements in the process that would provide enhanced control over future spending by recognizing long-term costs when decisions are made. Commitments and guarantees can seem cheap until the time comes to pay up. And all too often, elected officials at that point express surprise. If they take GAO's advice to consider fiscal liabilities more carefully, there could be fewer unpleasant surprises. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.